It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 6 states and 2 people are challenging President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan at the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll look at the arguments behind the case heard yesterday and what's at stake. First, the U.S. Senate recently confirmed President Biden's 100th judicial appointee. The number is now up over 105. For this point in his administration, that puts him ahead of the pace of confirmed appointees by previous presidents Trump, Obama, and George W. Bush. Biden has been highlighting the diversity of the appointments, including Judge Gina Mendez-Miro, who upon Senate confirmation became the first openly LGBTQ judge to serve on the U.S. District Court for the District of Puerto Rico. She was number 100. We're going to talk about that strategy from the White House and Democrats, what it means for the federal judiciary, and what it means for the justice system in the United States. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how these judge appointments and confirmations work at the federal level? What response do you have to the pace we've been seeing from the Biden administration and the Senate? Is it important to you to see a more diverse pool of judges going onto the bench? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Russ Feingold is a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He's the founder of Progressives United, a nonprofit organization supporting the rule of law and a fair-minded judiciary. He's the author of the book, The Constitution in Jeopardy. He's currently president of the Progressive American Constitution Society. Senator Feingold, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be on. Thank you very much.
I think a lot of public interest in the court system when it's there and a lot of the media coverage looks at the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk about the importance of these other federal appointments of the district courts and the courts of appeals around the country?
Well, they're absolutely crucial. Like the Supreme Court, which is, of course, the most important, the courts of appeal and the district court judges at the federal level are lifetime appointments. And so they are very important. In a lot of cases, the Court of Appeal decisions, like in our area, the Seventh Circuit, can sometimes end up being the last word if the Supreme Court does not get involved or is not able to get involved. So these judgeships are absolutely crucial. A lot of people's lives are decided, whether it's criminal or civil law, by these courts. And that's why it's so exciting, the pace that's being kept by the Biden administration and the Senate in getting new judges during this administration.
Can you talk a little more about that pace? The president has had a tied Senate and a tie-breaking vice president to get court appointments approved. Now with one more senator on the Democratic side of the aisle, do you expect that pace to continue?
Well, the pace has to continue. In fact, it has to increase. But this is a very good accomplishment. One of the great accomplishments of the Biden administration, as you were talking about at the outset, not only did they surpass the number from Trump. But now in this new year, the 100 judges have been confirmed. In fact, as of today, we're up to more. We're already up to about 108. It'll probably be 110 by the end of the week. So this is a good news thing to undo the damage that was done by the appointment of very, very right-wing, of course, Supreme Court justices, Court of Appeal justices, and district court judges under Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. But we need to see some faster action by the Senate and by the White House in order to achieve the real goal here, which is to make sure that after the whole game, not just the halftime, the whole administration is ahead of the Trump pace. And Trump got 234 total. So it's going to be necessary for the Senate to move much more quickly in 2023 to have and confirm over 100 judges this year to have a chance to undo the damage that has been done by the really unfair tactics that were used by the Trump administration and by the Senate under Mitch McConnell.
We distinguish often between Republican-appointed judges and Democratic-appointed judges. Somebody might look and say, hey, wait a minute. Shouldn't we just have, you know, judges who try to weigh the law fairly? Is there a way to get from this sort of partisan divide over which judges we appoint and get to something where we have neutral judges who, as they say it sometimes in Supreme Court confirmation hearings, call balls and strikes?
Absolutely. That should be the ideal at the federal level, and I might say for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where this is a very serious issue. The American Constitution Society does not feel the idea here is to appoint Democrat judges. That's not the goal. The goal is to recognize that under Trump and under McConnell, very extreme ideologues were appointed and who are acting in a very partisan way. What we want is a legitimate judiciary. We want a judiciary that is going to decide the cases on the merits and the parties before them, as you have suggested. But in order to have that, you have to make sure that the judges that are appointed reflect the diversity of America. In other words, not Democrat versus Republican, but that all the types of people in our country are represented. And as the introduction suggested, this is an incredible achievement, not just the pace, but of these over 100 judges, 80 under Biden have been women, and it was only 25% under Trump. 75 have been people of color, and 53 have been women of color. So for the first time in our history, we are beginning to undo the historic discrimination against women and minorities, African Americans and others, that have been reflected in our courts. It's very hard to feel that you're getting that fair shake when you go in the courtroom if none of the judges look anything like you. And that's exactly what we are beginning to reverse by the good work of the Biden administration and its allies.
Talking to former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold about appointments to federal courts around the country and what the Biden administration has been doing. You can join in with your thoughts on this, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Some Republicans and conservative groups, Senator Feingold, say maybe it's all well and good to have a more diverse court, but when you're looking at an individual appointment, you shouldn't be thinking about the overall balance, the demographics of the court system. You should be looking for the best qualified judge, regardless of background. What do you say to that argument?
Well, that's exactly what you should do. And that's the opposite of what Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell did. They wanted to pick people who had one characteristic, and that was not being the best qualified, but who was a strong right-wing conservative advocate who will twist the law in a way that will reflect the very far right in this country. That is what's wrong. Looking for people that reflect the diversity of this country and realizing that there are many African Americans, Latinos, LGBTQ people, people that have represented unions who should have been more represented in the courts in the past, and that they are ready to do it and ready to do a great job. This is exactly what has happened. These individuals are excellent judges, very well qualified, and nobody, to my knowledge, that we have supported at the American Constitution Society is anything other than outstandingly qualified to be a federal judge.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Don is with us on the road near Madison. Don, hi.
Hi. Hi, Senator Feingold. I have great respect for you, I have to tell you. The reason why I'm calling, though, this seems a little unrealistic in today's political climate, the fact that you don't think it's that important whether the judge is going to be or comes from a Democratic or Republican background, because the way that the Republicans are appointing judges, they're just to the extreme right and will continue to be to the extreme right. So isn't that the most important thing to counterbalance that rather than the fact that to try to have neutral judges?
Don, thanks.
Well, you know, a neutral, thanks, Don, for the kind words. Neutral is, I'm not sure the word is neutral. A judge should be somebody who has, of course, a life history, who is willing to look at all the different circumstances, who is willing to look at the law and the text of the law. But, you know, everybody has some kind of a background. The question is whether they have a reputation for fairness and open-mindedness. And I'll tell you, I handled a number of Supreme Court appointments as a senator, and I saw a difference between, for example, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito in terms of the extent to which I thought they could be neutral or reasonably unbiased in cases. And in the end, I voted for a Republican-appointed person in the Chief Justice Roberts, but not for Alito, because Alito looked to me like he wasn't able to be neutral, that he was on one side, particularly when it came to corporate decisions. So I don't think it's unrealistic to look for people who will really see themselves not as part of a political party or an ideology, but will see themselves as judges with a sacred responsibility to do justice. So I think the people that we've supported at the American Constitution Society reflect that. And I think it will make the courts a better place.
Don, thanks for that call. We're talking to Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society, talking about federal judges. President Biden's reaching a milestone recently of getting over the 100 judicial appointees confirmed mark. We're also going to talk about the growing importance of state courts, including our Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the federal court system, the importance of it, how the process works? What do you want to see when it comes to how people are appointed and confirmed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about the federal court system and how presidents work to shape it through their appointments. Russ Feingold is with us, former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, who served on the Senate Judiciary Committee, currently president of the American Constitution Society. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about how judges are appointed at the federal level or elected at the state level in some cases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's stop here in Wisconsin for a moment, Senator Feingold. Of course, we have a key Wisconsin State Supreme Court election in the works. Going to be a very expensive election, already is. Your thoughts on the importance of who is on a state Supreme Court?
Well, I'll tell you, this is a sad moment in the history of our court system in Wisconsin and nationally, because it never used to be like this, as we were saying earlier. I mean, this thing has become so partisan and so one side versus the other that it doesn't reflect at all what the court should be. And that's why this race is so important, because the Wisconsin Supreme Court has now come off in the last few years as one of the most partisan Supreme Courts in the history of not only of our state, but the whole country. According to the New York Times, this race for the Supreme Court of Wisconsin is the number one political race of the entire year in the entire nation. And that's really for two reasons. One is the Supreme Court has been captured by the use of various tactics by very far-right justices who are undermining the rights of Americans, including a woman's right to choose. So what happens is it gets kicked back to the states. What are the state's laws? What does the state constitution say? And of course, what would the Supreme Court of Wisconsin say about it? So that's one reason. The other reason it's so critical is that we used to have essentially nonpartisan races for Supreme Court. It was understood that it was sort of inappropriate for the political parties to be too involved in those. And now for many years, it's become Democrat versus Republican. And that just is not the best way to get a result that will ever look like justice. We need the seven justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court to work with each other, to reason with each other, and to try to come not necessarily to unanimous decisions, but to be able to not have it always based on who they think the political party of the person is. And I am hoping the outcome of this election will restore the court to being a real Supreme Court rather than what it has been for the last few years.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, I was wondering, is there any minimum qualifications to be appointed or elected a state or federal judge, or is it all just based on your ability to raise money or get that appointment? And then the other question, I've heard you're talking about, how can we move away from this electing state Supreme Court justices and go to some kind of an appointed method, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Let's take those one at a time. Are there minimum qualifications? Let's just say with the federal judge appointment, do I have to have something on my resume to even qualify to be appointed, Senator Feingold?
I believe you have to be a lawyer, that you have to have a law degree. I'm not absolutely certain if that is true everywhere in the country, but I believe it to be the case in Wisconsin. But beyond that, we have elected offices here. And people stand for office. And basically, if you're of age in terms of voting age and residency, my understanding is that you don't have to have a minimum number of years of practice of the law. You can run. Now, of course, you're going to probably do better if you're running for a high office like Supreme Court if you have more experience. But a lot of people run for the circuit court judgeships who would not have as much of that experience. So no, it is pretty open as long as you have a law degree and are admitted to the bar, as I understand it.
Thanks for that call. And then his question following up on what you were just saying, Jimmy, hoping to see something maybe different than our effectively partisan, though officially nonpartisan elections, including maybe merit-based or judicial appointments here in Wisconsin. That would be a tall order for a state to make that switch, but not impossible.
It's been done by a number of states, and you know, I would have thought this was a terrible thing years ago, but when I see what's happened, as the caller suggested, with all this money sloshing around and the campaigns becoming very partisan and really political campaigns based on party, maybe it is time to have a real conversation about whether instead of having elections for all these, that there would be some kind of commission. That's something that should be debated by people from all political backgrounds. The legislature and the governor would have to consider it. And of course, there may have to be a constitutional amendment to make that happen. But I think the people of the state ought to take a look at it, because right now this is not this is not an attractive thing that makes us look like the court is doing justice. It makes it look like the court is following political agendas. And so I think maybe it is time to have that conversation. They've switched to it in other states, and I think with some success.
Thanks for that call, Jimmy. Mark joins us now in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hello.
Hi there. Well, I think the elephant in the room is gerrymandering. So I wonder if Ms. Feingold thinks that getting a judge like Protasiewicz, I believe that's how you pronounce her name, is going to be more inclined to do something about gerrymandering and
Mark,
the stranglehold.
I gotcha, Mark. Senator Feingold, I know your group doesn't endorse particular candidates, but on the issue of gerrymandering, this is something that's come before the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and all points between. Is this an issue you're following?
Well, very closely. And Wisconsin has been one of the most important states in terms of this gerrymandering issue. Our state legislature is grossly gerrymandered in a way that allows Republicans to actually gain ground when they are losing ground in the entire state in almost every statewide election. So there's something terribly wrong with that. A lawsuit was brought to try to challenge this that went all the way to the Supreme Court, but lost. So now what you're looking at, the importance of this race for the Supreme Court, is things like the Wisconsin abortion ban and the Republican gerrymandered legislative maps will reach the Wisconsin Supreme Court for decision after April 4th. And it is essential that the court have a group of justices, or at least a majority of justices, who are going to follow the law here, rather than follow a political agenda of the far right. So that is going to be the challenge. And also the election results are going to be greatly affected. The rules about voting, early voting, rules about whether or not you can have drop boxes for voting. These things will all come before this court. So whoever you're supporting, people should know that that is what's at stake in this election in Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. Talking to former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold about the appointments and, in some cases, elections of judges at the federal and the state level. Back to your calls now with Tim in Genesee Depot. Tim, hi.
Hi. Hello, Senator. Nice that you're still around and doing things. We really miss you. About 25 years ago, you spoke at our children's high school in Kettle Moraine, and there were a number of judicial appointments that were coming up at that point, and you were talking to the kids and saying how important it is to vote in all elections, because you vote for the representatives and the senators, and those are the people that appoint the justices. I'd just like to have you reiterate that, how important it is to vote in all of the general elections, and I'll take your comments off the line. Thanks a lot.
Senator. Well, what a wonderful memory you have 25 years ago by making those comments. But yes, it is vital that somebody doesn't just vote for governor, president, or senator. They need to go what we call this down ballot. In other words, they vote for the court races. They vote for the district attorneys. They vote for the secretary of state. Because as we've seen in the last couple of years, all of these get involved in things like how votes are counted, whether somebody is allowed to vote in a reasonable manner. And so, yes, voting down ballot all the way is crucial. Our American Constitution Society put a strong emphasis on communicating to people in the last election that they needed to vote down ballot. And nationally, it was much better. There were far fewer people who were sort of stopping right after the big races. And we're going to keep pushing that message straight through 2024 so that people vote for all the offices, because so many of them have a lot to do with who wins an election. And it also has a lot to do with whether you get justice when you go before a judge.
Thanks for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Senator Feingold, I think you're best known nationally for the legislation you advanced with the late Senator John McCain on campaign finance reform. A lot of that has been overturned by courts. We're seeing maybe the effect of some of that in the spending in the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. Your thoughts on, in just our last minute or so, on the state of money in politics?
Well, it's completely out of control. As you indicated, our actual bill was not overturned, but they did overturn a 1907 law that Fighting Bob of La Follette of Wisconsin helped pass that said corporations couldn't do this kind of thing. And the Supreme Court overturned that 5-4 in 2010. That has to change, or you're going to continue to have this gross amount of money being spent in this election in Wisconsin and across the country. And much of this is in the political elections, the partisan elections, is hidden. And so the people of the country don't even know who is putting this kind of control into the system. And that's exactly what the reformers back in the early 20th century tried to stop. So this is a crucial job of the courts as well as legislators.
Senator Feingold, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It was fun. Thanks.
That's Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society. We talked to him today about how President Biden and Democrats are working to reshape and diversify the federal judicial system after the Senate confirmed more than 100 of Biden's judicial appointees. Also took a look at state courts and the current race for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Coming up after the news, we're going to stay in the court system. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on a challenge to the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan. We'll check out the legal challenge and what's at stake, and we'll keep taking your calls. If you have a question about that or a thought on that case, you can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Also coming up, we'll take a look at a food pantry in the Abbotsford area that's distributing food and building community in central Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a geologist tells us how earthquakes reverberate through the earth and how seismology is helping to uncover what lies at the center of our planet. First, a central Wisconsin food pantry has grown into a hub for social services and community. The Abbotsford Area Collaborative Team distributes food. It also connects hundreds of families to health care and other services. And its leader says he's meeting more families every week who need help. Rob Metzer reports.
Been you here in Abbotsford or no?
It's about 10 degrees in Abbotsford. Outside St. Bernard's Catholic Church, the Reverend Tim Odenhoven is talking with a man who's waiting in line for the food pantry. The man doesn't have a winter coat.
You enter like this in a basement, you take a mucho chamada
spouse. Odenhoven tells the man he's welcome to go down to the church basement and pick out one of the coats there from the donations pile.
You have a look at this, is it, okay? Donors pouch to this.
Take what you need, okay? They're all for you. Odenhoven is the priest at St. Bernard's. For the last 3 years, he's also led the church's food pantry. Every Thursday, they distribute food to about 230 families in the rural central Wisconsin region. Odenhoven says the food pantry was initially a pandemic response.
We grew very quickly from the onset. I mean, it started maybe with 30, 40 families, with the federal aid boxes, the farm-to-family boxes, and then it just mushroomed to where we're serving 100, 150 families and 200 families. And the 230 we're at right now, it's going to go up from there.
Unemployment rates in Wisconsin have been at record lows. But Suzanne Becker says food pantries across the state have seen demand increase. She leads the Eau Claire-based Feed My People food bank and says many clients are people who have jobs.
Maybe they're the two parents who are working and they're paying their bills. But there's nothing left over at the end of the day.
The United Way has focused on the challenges of these families. They have incomes above the federal poverty line, but below the expenses of rent, food, and childcare. When the price of groceries or gas goes up, they feel the pinch.
There's no wiggle room, right? That's what we have seen. We've seen all kinds of families finding themselves in need for the first time.
Now, food pantries across the state are bracing for a new increase in demand. That's because in March, about 400,000 Wisconsin families will see a reduction in their food share benefits. During the pandemic, families received at least $95 per month in additional benefits from the federal government. In December, Congress voted to bring those additional benefits to an end. In Abbotsford, some families have another challenge. About half the population here are Latino immigrants, and many don't have legal status. Odenhoven is not Hispanic, but he's worked to build trust in the Latino community. He preaches two Spanish-language masses each week. He says he speaks more Spanish than English every day. And that wasn't the case when he came to Abbotsford 12 years ago.
It was very hard. Yeah, I started speaking pretty much no Spanish, and back then, most of them didn't speak any English. Of course, that's changed over 12 years now, as the people have been here longer. So we were all kind of new together. A lot of people had just arrived at that point, so it really was we're all in this together.
The food pantry has also partnered with H2N, a Wausau-based organization that promotes health equity. Isis Vidal with H2N has been coming to Abbotsford each week for more than 2 years. She and others help clients take care of health care or transportation needs. Vidal immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico more than 2 decades ago.
Now I know how those people feel, you know, like when they don't know when they are new in town and they don't know who can help them.
So this is for my primary staff.
On a tour of the church, Odenhoven opens a confessional door.
This used to be a confessional. It's no longer.
It's filled nearly to the ceiling with boxes of rice, dried beans, cereal. He says operating the food pantry has been eye-opening.
I do believe that there was a need that we just didn't notice before, and it was that unheard need, and that's a problem.
Odenhoven is making plans to expand the kind of support residents can get through the church. This spring, the Family Health Center of Marshfield will be opening a permanent health clinic in the church's basement. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, six Republican-led states and two individuals are challenging President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan at the U.S. Supreme Court. In August of last year, Biden announced his plan for anyone making less than $125,000 a year. It would forgive $10,000 to students with federal loan debt, 20,000 students with that debt who had a Pell Grant. 26 million borrowers applied since then, but the loan forgiveness may or may not happen depending on the Supreme Court's ruling. The court heard arguments in that case yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping comes out of this case? Do you have questions about what's at stake, what the Supreme Court is reviewing in this challenge? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Caspers, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, director of the university's Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start us off by telling us why this case ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court? What are the basics of this challenge?
Yeah, sure. Well, the case itself is, it basically raises two questions. One of them relates to whether or not the executive branch has the power to implement this plan. And the plan itself is based off of what's called the HEROES Act, which HEROES there is an acronym standing for Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act. That was passed after 9/11 to make changes to student loan programs during emergencies. And that program was actually used by the Trump administration in 2020 to suspend student loan repayments and interest accrual because of COVID-19. It's now being cited as the law the Biden administration is using to forgive student loan debts, as you mentioned earlier, in some significant amounts. And so that is what is the basic challenge from the plaintiffs in these two cases before the court, is whether or not the executive branch was delegated that authority by Congress. There's also the threshold question before that one, which is whether or not the plaintiffs that have brought these cases have legal standing to actually challenge the legality of the program in court.
Let's get to that. What did Congress authorize here? Question. I want to listen to Justice Brett Kavanaugh talking to Nebraska's Solicitor General about that HEROES Act you were just mentioning. Here is a listen to, I guess, a key word in the original statute.
But what do you do with the word waive? That is an extremely broad word. Why not just read that as written?
Your Honor, I believe we are reading it as written. Waive means to excuse compliance with an existing obligation, and what the Secretary is purporting to do here is to change existing loan discharge program. The Secretary is not dealing with any of these existing provisions that he purports to cite. He's not changing anything within them. He's frankly ignoring what's there and creating a brand new program, and that's not within the language of this statute.
That's the word waive, W-A-I-V-E. How much hangs on, Eric, what Congress meant by that, the breadth of the authority that they were trying to give executive branch, the presidency here?
Well, yeah, on the substantive question of whether or not this authority was delegated by Congress to the executive branch, the meaning of that word waive, or how the Supreme Court interprets that word, there's a lot that would hang on that. The exact language in the relevant statute there in the HEROES Act says that the Secretary of Education can waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision applicable to student aid programs when necessary in connection with a war or other military operation or national emergency. And so yesterday there was some significant back and forth on what that word waive means. The position that was taken by the U.S. government, by the Solicitor General's office, is that waive can, if you waive something, for instance, if you're waiving a requirement, it can, you know, negate something entirely in terms of that requirement. And so the argument from the federal government is that this is exactly what Congress was contemplating, is the ability to waive those financial obligations by borrowers entirely. On the other hand, what you saw from the parties raising the lawsuits is that the use of the word waive and modify, they were arguing, was chosen very carefully by Congress. Congress did not say cancel or cancellation. And so if you want to read it in the sense that Congress didn't say cancel, it didn't specifically deal with what's being characterized as discharging this obligation entirely for a certain amount of borrowing, then this is not authorized by the statute.
Brand.
Part of what it really comes down to, which we can get into now or later, is the U.S. Supreme Court in some of its decisions, especially last year in a case called West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency. It clarified what it means when it discusses what's called the major questions mm-hmm. doctrine. And with that doctrine, the court says that Congress has to speak clearly if it wishes to assign an agency decisions of what the court calls vast economic and political significance. So because of those past decisions, there's a real question as to whether or not the court will let this program stand, because it is one of these vast economic programs dealing with, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tina is with us in Lake Geneva. Tina, hello.
Hi. So I just really feel sad for this generation. My son voted for Biden specifically on this premise. He applied for the $20,000. He was told that, got an email saying that his application was accepted and it would be approved. And then another email shortly after saying, oh, wait a minute, not so much. So I think it's a fraudulent premise. I think we all knew from the beginning of its inception what this was going to be. And I don't think it's fair now after the fact to say, oh, wait, no, wait, don't wait. You like, you know, to get hung up on semantics of wording. I don't think that's right. I think it's just not fair.
Tina, thanks a lot for the call. Eric, the semantics of the wording could have a big impact on Tina's son and other people applying here.
Yeah, it could. And, you know, there is, on the one hand, kind of the big policy question. And there were, of course, a significant percentage of the population that supports this plan. But even if the program is popular, you know, part of what the courts are going to look at if something gets filed as a case like this is whether or not everything was done procedurally correctly, and whether or not, again, when the executive branch takes action like this, whether they were authorized to do so by Congress. It's certainly, as the Solicitor General was arguing yesterday, the word waive can be interpreted in that way to authorize what was done here. But sometimes it will come down to, you know, the justices, if they want to be very textualist about it, it's not uncommon for them to, you know, look up these words in the dictionary and to use the definitions there to kind of guide them as to how to interpret the meaning of that word.
Thanks for the call, Tina. We're talking to Eric Casper, political science professor at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court hearing yesterday on President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the U.S. Supreme Court to approve this plan or reject it? Do you think that whatever you think of the policy itself, do you think it's a case of a president overstepping their authority? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Eric Casper, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, with us to talk about a court challenge to President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in that case yesterday. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. Eric, I want to give a listen to another justice. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor, talking about the possible impact of turning back on this loan forgiveness plan.
The evidence is clear that many of them will have to default. Their financial situation will be even worse because once you default, the hardship on you is exponentially greater. You can't get credit. You're going to pay higher prices for things. They are going to continue to suffer from this pandemic in a way that the general population doesn't. And what you're saying is now we're going to give judges the right to decide how much aid to give them.
And it sounds, Eric, like Justice Sotomayor is leaning toward that argument that under this HEROES Act, this constitutes an emergency measure that would give the executive branch this authority. What do you make of that?
Yeah, she was. And it's an argument that was also being made by the Solicitor General, because that's one of the requirements in the HEROES Act, that this would be for a war or some sort of national emergency. And the argument in that regard is that, and this was the exact language used by the Solicitor General, it was a once in the COVID-19 is a once in a century pandemic. And in that regard, more than a million Americans have died from it. Many more have been hospitalized. And with businesses being shut down and people being put out of work and unable to pay their bills, that the argument is that, well, the HEROES Act was written to deal with just this sort of national and even global emergency. And so therefore, the Secretary of Education can implement this relief plan. The plaintiffs in the case were saying, well, if there was a national emergency, that, you know, we're at the end of that. And so therefore, even if there was the opportunity to use this act earlier during the pandemic, that delegation was limited to a time when you really have an emergency that is ongoing. And if we're no longer in what the administration would characterize as a national emergency, then the plaintiff's argument is that, well, the ability to implement the HEROES Act to do something like this, that time has passed.
Let's go back to our callers now. Betty is with us in Delavan. Betty, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you're talking about this forgiveness of student loans. My son worked hard as a busboy, saved $10,000 of his tips and his pay to pay for Madison first year by himself, and then he paid cash the rest of the 4 years. So should he get some payback for that? It's silly. You go to school, you take out a loan, you pay your loans back.
Betty, thanks for the call. This has been a policy argument about this, Eric, but I think it also came up in the court hearings yesterday, the idea of, is this unfair to people, as Betty's son did, paid their way through college, or to people who don't go to college at all?
Yeah, that came up in two different ways yesterday. One is that one of the two lawsuits was filed by borrowers who either had loans held by commercial lenders, and therefore they were not eligible for any of this relief, or they weren't eligible for the full $20,000 because they didn't receive a Pell Grant. And so at least those plaintiffs were arguing that, look, we have loans, we're not getting them forgiven, or we're not giving as much that's being forgiven. And that was the kind of the basis of their lawsuit challenging the legality of the program. There was also, during oral argument, a statement that was made by Chief Justice Roberts. He was questioning the fairness of the student debt relief when there are other people who have taken out loans for other purposes, such as to if you wanted to start a business and those loans weren't being forgiven. There was a little bit of pushback on that in terms of, is that an argument about the legality of the program versus there being a policy argument? But on the initial threshold question of standing, whether or not someone whose loans are not eligible for this relief can even bring the lawsuit, that was part of what was discussed in front of the Supreme Court yesterday.
And staying with thanks again for that call, Betty. Staying with standing, the states involved, there are questions about, well, do they have standing? What was the argument there?
Yeah, the argument there came down to largely this Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, which goes by the acronym of MOHELA. It's a state creation to hold and service student loans. It's kind of a quasi-independent entity. And so the question there is, well, is it connected to Missouri enough so that, you know, the state can file this lawsuit on behalf of this MOHELA or this type of state created authority? The states obviously were arguing that they did have standing. The Solicitor General's office on behalf of the federal government was saying that, no, I mean, the MOHELA and these types of agencies, if they have their own ability to file a lawsuit, then they should do that on their own and not have the states doing it for them, because, I mean, the states aren't the ones who are suffering the real injury. Now, the interesting thing about that is even the Solicitor General's office admitted that if this other entity, this MOHELA, for instance, would have standing if it's sued, then that could lead to either potentially the justices overlooking the standing issue because of the inevitability of MOHELA just coming back and filing its own lawsuit as its own entity rather than having the state do it for them. So if they were to rule against the states having standing, it wouldn't necessarily be the end of the case, and it could be back in courts.
Time for one more caller. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hello. I was thinking about the word waive, and couldn't they ask the senators who passed the law, since they're probably still living, and the congressmen, what they meant by that word?
Carol, thanks for the call. And Carol points us toward a great question to close with. Eric, justices at all levels have to figure out what members of Congress meant when they wrote legislation. Is it as simple as going and asking them, or what?
Well, not at the Supreme Court level. You know, potentially, you know, calling someone as a witness in a trial level situation, I mean, that's not unheard of if they were connected to getting the legislation passed. And there's actually a disagreement amongst the justices and in the legal community, you know, how much stock should you put into legislative intent as far as going back to the records in Congress to see what they were saying in floor debate and what they were introducing while they were debating the legislation versus just looking at the text as it's written and then, you know, using other sources to try and interpret that language. But to that point, the justices could, when they go back and decide how they're going to handle this case, in their opinion, they could go back and cite some of the things that were said in the House or in the Senate when this legislation was being debated.
Carol, thanks for that call. And Eric, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Casper, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, director there of the Center for Constitutional Studies. He joined us today to talk about challenges facing President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on a lawsuit challenging that plan. A verdict, a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, not expected till spring at the very earliest, possibly not until this summer. If you have more questions about what this all means, what it might mean for you individually, let us know, and we can try to figure out those answers for you. You can email anytime, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. If you are feeling ready to get out into the garden, a little antsy with the last month or so of winter-like weather, you are not alone. And you can do it even if you don't have your own yard to put a garden in. Join a tour of community gardens around Wisconsin and find out how to get involved, plus share your own stories if you've been part of a community garden in your own neck of the woods. Join that conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Some news in the world of cars. The manual transmission, the stick shift, is making a comeback, sort of. As reported by the Wall Street Journal, it's not a huge comeback. 1.7% of new cars sold in the U.S. so far this year had manual transmissions, but that's up from 1.2% last year and just 0.9% the year before. They talked to some drivers. Part of the reason they're going back to stick shift is it's fun, which is true. Now, when I learned to drive, my mom's car was a stick shift. My dad's truck was a stick shift, so I had to learn. The car I learned easy, no problem. The truck, for some reason, I had real trouble. I stalled it a lot, ground the gears sometimes, not good. But then one night, I had a dream where I drove the truck. That was it, driving the truck and shifting. And the next time I drove it in real waking life, boom, no problem at all. That remains the only time in my entire life when I actually learned something useful in a dream. Keep on trucking. This is Central Time.